Go to our Facebook page as well, Behind the Headlines. If you go to www.facebook.com and type in the search Behind the Headlines, it will take you to our page there, where you can find links to our Cloudcasts and every other post that's on there. So take a look at that. It's been an interesting hour, actually, Humane. Just before you arrived, we've been talking about Egypt. I don't know how much you've been following.
Yeah, I've been watching that very closely. I mean, actually, a lot of people are saying Mubarak should stay in power, which I found a bit surprising.
It is surprising, but it's not actually surprising. If you look at it, the Israelis are really, really wanting Mubarak to stay in power. We should have Alan Haas back online. Good evening, Alan.
Hello, can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you very much. Our apologies.
I can hardly hear you again. Somebody's around.
Yes, our apologies to you with the technical issues we are having today.
Yeah, you've got gremlins. I can't hear you. You're coming from the other side of the moon.
Yes, our apologies about that. We should have Tony Gosling on the line as well.
Hi, yes.
Good evening, Tony.
Hello,
good evening, Tony.
Yes, I can hear.
Fantastic. Alan's, we are having a lot of problem with the Alan Hart at the moment on the phone lines. We will get Alan Hart back on for you next week, all being well. Tony, it's been an interesting week.
Yes, it certainly has. And I think, you know, most people's eyes around the world are focused on Egypt at the moment. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't been able to hear what Alan has been saying about it. But certainly my view is that there is an immense amount of trickery going on right now in order to keep the Egyptian people on the back foot. Now, the words, obviously, coming out of the West are all about democracy and peaceful transition and this kind of thing, whereas actually the actions on the ground really contradict that. So, you know, the thing is, in a situation like this, where you've got a mass of people who are trying to literally to get justice and democracy going in their country, the impasse that's now taking place in Egypt is really crucial. What the outside powers, and I think Alan would agree with me here, what power, the powers in the West, for example, I mean, we can't expect much from China, obviously, but from the democracies in the West and the semi-democracies in the West, you'd probably call them, can be absolutely decisive. What annoys me almost more than anything else is the way that this Hosni Mubarak chap is just simply, he's actually lying about his role over the last decades. Because when he's saying that I have served Egypt, he doesn't actually mean that at all. And he hasn't been a servant of Egypt. He has used the Egyptian people to feather his own nest and the feather the nest of his Western sponsors. I mean, we've had the Egyptian people. My heart really does go out to them because...
Hello?
We seem to have lost Tony again.
They did bring something up that how Mubarak claimed he served the country. I mean, I think he does have a point. I mean, like I said, I've been watching and I've been keeping a close eye on what's happening in Egypt. I have a friend who's supposed to go on Egypt for a holiday, but I think that's going to be cancelled. But yeah, I mean, it's for the people of Egypt. They want the way. I mean, the first couple of days is really peaceful, and the army seemed to be on their side too. And all of a sudden, the Mubarak supporters seem to be coming in, and and the whole riots come about, and the peaceful march turned out to be a very aggressive, violent anger towards each other, where the Egyptian people are fighting amongst each other. And I mean, the unrest in Egypt is sad amongst the Arab world, you know. I mean, even after the people taking inspiration from Tunisia, and they want to be free from this regime, from the current Egyptian president Mubarak. So yeah, but like I said, I mean, America have got a strong stance. They want Mubarak gone, and I fully agree with him. I mean, but certain sectors in this country, also across the world, want him to stay.
Well, mainly
in fear of the opposition of the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, I think they're called.
But I think more than the Egyptian people or the Muslim Brotherhood, I think what's interesting here, Humayun, is that how Israel are really, really urging Mubarak actually to stay on. I mean, we do have Tony Gosling back on. Tony, good evening and welcome back. So, our sincere apology with the technical issue.
Can you hear me clearly this time?
Yes, we can.
Okay, lovely. Yes, and my concern is that there is actually a lot going on behind the scenes in Egypt in order to try and really literally to buy time for Mubarak and his friends to buy time. And as I was saying, the role of the Western powers is crucial in all this. What we really need is any democratic leaders in the West who actually do really believe in democracy rather than, you know, strut around on the stage talking about it, but then actually they want to just do whatever they want without reference to what the people want in countries like Britain, France, Germany, and elsewhere. I mean, they've really, really got to speak out right now and say that and explain what everybody in Egypt knows to the world in English, preferably, as it's a language which lots and lots of people around the world use.
Absolutely,
that Mubarak must go because he is actually standing in the way of the progress and development of Egypt and the Egyptian people. And anybody else who is strongly associated with him and his regime is actually stopping the country developing. And there are several reasons that are being given for the possible, you know, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood, people saying that this is a very dangerous organization, and if we allow democracy in Egypt, that these people may come to power. This is just simply fear-mongering. If you mean democracy, it's a bit like free speech. If you believe in free speech, you believe in the right for people to say things that you fundamentally disagree with. If you believe in democracy, you agree and you believe in the right of people to elect a government that you also disagree with. And actually, this is not necessarily a bad thing for the world to have people who don't agree with each other, because it's very, very easy actually to get along with people you don't agree with. If you ever go down to the House of Commons bar or to the House of Commons restaurant, you'll find some of the most vehement political opponents sitting down, having a drink and a laugh and eating meals together. This is the way things really should be, is that you can disagree with somebody, but that doesn't mean to say you dislike them or that you want to go to war with them. This is a mature way to run the world, through disagreement, discussion, argument, and resolution.
I
think that's really what we need in the Middle East, and that's what the people in Egypt need, is to be able to actually express through their government their aspirations honestly, rather than to have a kind of sham version, a puppet leader, or anything similar, you know, that doesn't actually express, as is an Egyptian view, what the Egyptian people's views really are. And we've got a real chance here in Egypt to actually change things around in the Middle East, to get rid of some of these. I mean, we hear also, of course, about Saudi Arabia, which is a monarchy and virtually a dictatorship, and we don't hear enough about actually getting democracy of some sort going in Saudi Arabia, because it doesn't suit us, because the Saudi kings have always been very, very loyal to the West. So I'm watching Egypt very, very carefully, and it's nice to see that today a lot more people have come out on the streets. The Egyptian people are not going away, and that they are not simply going to do a deal with Mubarak for him to stay in power for longer, or any of the guy who runs his secret police, etc., because we really do need to have a transition to democracy in the Middle East if the country is going to be a peaceful, nice place to live. And also, of course, it would mean that there will be less possibility of civil unrest and war around the Middle East if the people get justice, and if the people who get the leaders that they actually want to rule the country, rather than a despot like Mubarak, who's been imposed from abroad.
Well, I mean, you know, Mubarak's taking power. I mean, Israel are really, really behind the scene, are urging actually him to stay in power and not to give in to the Egyptian public. What do you make of that? What are your thoughts on that, Tony?
Well,
sorry, you're sounding really fuzzy. I can hardly hear you. Maybe I should phone you back.
What is your thoughts on the
a lot of gremlins on the phones today.
We have.
So
we really
I'm afraid I can't actually hear your question, so I'll call you back in a minute.
Okay.
Tony Gosling there again. We are having a lot of issues with our telephone lines today. It is unfortunate. 0121-772-8892 if you want to call in with your thoughts and comments, if you want to talk about Egypt, if you want to talk about anything else that you heard in the program today. Our apologies again, and sincerest apologies to Alan Hartz. We will bring you Alan Hartz next week. We will talk a little bit more in depth about the Middle East and about Alan's new book. So if you could bear with us, Tony will be back with us very, very shortly.
To be fair, Tony did bring up some good points about the Egyptian regime and how the people deserve to get a new leader and the voice their opinion. And
absolutely.
And it's kind of sad how Britain do bang the drum about democracy and yet did not really push in a leader or a dictator, in my opinion.
Well, you see, the thing there is, Simeon, and you have made a very interesting comment that Britain is banging their drum about democracy, and we do have Tony back, I believe. Good evening, Tony.
Nope, he's gone.
I'm afraid we're having a lot of problems with this. Humane, please do continue with
us. How Britain and Cameron are banging the drum about democracy, and yet they haven't made a clear stance, the clear indication of what they feel about Egypt and how they should move forward. I mean, Obama has made it clear that he wants Mubarak to go and make a clear transition. I think Mubarak's excuse is he doesn't want to part way so quickly because he fears the country will simply fall apart if he leaves straight away, and he won't run for.
Tony, what's going on here? Please do continue. I'll get we'll get it sorted.
Yeah. Obama has kept his stance. How. He wants a transition, a good, quick transition of government in Egypt. Give what the people of Egypt want, a new government, and they're sick and tired of the old one. I think Tunisia did start it off, and the transition is like a domino effect of the Arab world, you know, Egypt, Jordan, and a few other Arab countries are making a stance against the government. But it's good to see, and it'd be nice if a few of the other countries who would help the Egyptian people in the course of this regime's change. I mean, the people of Egypt deserve a new leader, a new government. But there are people in this country and across the globe who say the current president Mubarak should stay in power and should step down in September purely because of the new government of Egypt could get the Muslim Brotherhood in fear of implanting Sharia law. I think what I heard over the weekend. So it's I can see both sides of the argument, but I still think Mubarak should leave. Egypt is, I mean, it's a beautiful country. I haven't been there, but my brother lived there, and he told me quite a few stories. It's a beautiful country, but the regime, it needs to change. The people of Egypt, I mentioned it before, they are starved of the freedom, and they've been crying out for a change over a couple of years now, and I think the Tunisian leadership change and what happened there just ignited the flames of the Egyptian people. But as I mentioned before, the people, even the local politicians and the politicians across the globe, in fear of with opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood, and what they could bring, and Saeed said, Israel would be affected. That the Muslim Brotherhood are very, very, would you say, hardcore? Maybe I don't know if that's the right word. Hardcore group Islamic people. Hello. So the people of Egypt do deserve a new leader. But hopefully, it should be a bright future for them.
I hope so. Anyway, let's pick up the point back with Tony. Good evening, Tony.
The video games thing, a lot of this military gaming stuff is actually, I mean, people don't necessarily realise that a lot of the military, particularly in the academies, military academies around the world, they spend a lot of their time playing games and developing games. For example, you know, sort of strategic, tactical games, We did a piece on our dialect program we do here in Bristol on Sundays a couple of months ago on a magazine which is called Strategy and Tactics, which is a US magazine.
Interesting.
It's been going for something like 30 or 40 years. It comes out, I think it's every 2 months or every 2 months. And in that magazine, you get a whole load of stuff about military things that are new developments in the military, things that have suddenly become public after being secret military projects for 20 years or so, that kind of thing. But the other thing is you actually get a game as part of the magazine.
Mm.
The Strategy and Tactics cost something like £100 for a 2-year subscription. And it is a kind of public version of what's going on behind the scenes. A lot of people that started the magazine, there's a guy called Jim Dunnigan in the US, was actually involved in the military and then decided he wanted to take this whole idea of historical simulations and make a business out of it. And he did extremely well. It's now run by a company called Decision Games. It was bought off Jim. And this is it's really important to understand that this is gamesmanship is one of the things that these generals who run these wars around the world, the Second World War and all the other things that have happened since, that they spend a lot of their time actually playing around. I mean, for example, a friend of mine who's in the military, when he was actually at Sandhurst, he was telling me recently that when he was doing his training at Sandhurst, they had an exercise, which was over several days, which involved a saucepan-shaped island in the Mediterranean. And the invasion of that island. Now, you don't need to be a genius to work out that Cyprus is a kind of saucepan shape.
Mm.
And he said he was rather surprised because just not long after he graduated, there was actually an invasion of Cyprus.
Interesting.
So you can see that when these things happen for real, it's often something that's actually been played out through military war games many, many times over. And, of course, we're now entering something called the computer age.
Mm.
Now, this brings these whole sort of desk, tabletop games into a whole new sphere. But don't forget one thing. There's one chap called Miles Copeland, and he was in the Central Intelligence Agency in the Middle East. I think it was the Egypt desk or the Middle Eastern desk of the CIA, and he actually wrote a book called The Game of Nations. Now, The Game of Nations is all about how on one level, on this military level, much of what is going on in diplomatic circles is actually played like a kind of chess game. You know, it's a quid pro quo. We will do this, and they might do that in return. So rather than using high morals, things like justice, honesty, democracy, these kinds of things, they're not actually thinking like that. They're just thinking about, well, if we do this, they are likely to react like that, then we can do that, and then we can take over this piece of territory. So that book, The Game of Nations, and it was also a game sort of you could buy in Woolworths called The Game of Nations back in the late 70s and 80s, called The Game of Nations, which was about an oil-rich area. And so you could sit there, around there, and we used to do this as teenagers, you know. We'd sit around and play, you know, I will take over this oil field and see if I can get more supplies out than you. But now in this age of computers, everything goes up to a whole nother level. And, of course, the military are actually using all sorts of game software that's been developed within the military is now having spin-offs in the outside world.
How much impact do you think that then? I mean, we have heard over the years that how impacts the media makes on youngsters of today. And before, we heard a lot about music. We heard a lot about, the video games. But this military one, I mean, how much of an impact do you think it makes on the youngsters of today?
Well, I think it has a tremendous impact, and one of the reasons for that is that a lot of youngsters, particularly now, feel very disempowered. Now, let me tell you, I can remember a few years ago seeing some literature which was being sent out by video games companies to pubs. You know, these kind of things that you get a video games console in the pub and you play it or play it. You don't see so many of them these days, but certainly there was a whole phase of rage.
Well, the arcade-style game machines.
Their message was, that this is the marketing message to the publicans, was to your visitors, this game will mean power. To you, it will mean money.
Interesting.
Now, what they were doing was actually selling the idea of disempowered people actually getting involved in playing these games in order to give them a sense that they had some power. And now let's just look at what's been happening since the Cameron government got in, is we've seen a massive disempowerment of young people. First of all, we're now saying to them, well, if you want an education, you're going to have an iron ring of debt round your neck, possibly for the rest of your life. We're also saying that we're taking away many of the basic things that young people need in order to actually get any kind of education beyond the basic school secondary education. And sometimes, they'll find it even difficult to take A-levels and things like that. So we've seen a big leap in youth unemployment. So what's happening is, for a lot of young people, they really do feel what the Sex Pistols song said back in all those years ago, is no future. They feel there isn't a future for them. They feel that there is not a career path. They feel they may get basically, they will not get a chance to use the skills that they've learned in a career. And the one way out of this is the video game. This is where they get their empowerment from. They can sit in front of a screen and they can feel like they're
control.
Somehow they count. You know, I can kill more people than somebody else in a video game, therefore I've got some power. Now, actually, this is a very, very powerful hypnotic psychological illusion that's being perpetrated on our youngsters. And of course, it's very, very addictive, incredibly addictive, because these games are designed to reward you after lots and lots and lots of effort. And it's almost like gambling or something. If you've invested a certain amount of time in playing a game, then you feel that you actually want to get something out of that, which is some kind of reward on screen, for example, in some of these military style games, it's a promotion, or it might be that you are actually then put, rather than just as an individual soldier in one of these games, you're put in charge of a squad. This is the kind of way that this works. One of the most, I think, pernicious games came out, I think it was in November, obviously this was released for the Christmas market, and it's called Black Ops. Yeah. I think it's part of the Call of Duty game.
That's right, yeah.
Now, this, I mean, I've never actually played one of these things.
No, I haven't either.
What I have seen is simulations of them on YouTube, you know, where you can see what actually happens as part of the game. And you can see how youngsters are dragged into this. And, of course, it's a tacit kind of military mindset training. The idea is to normalise the idea of going into villages and massacring people. This is really dangerous because we've got a disaffected youth, and this is the kind of thing that it actually does start to make them feel like they count, like they mean something. But it's all an illusion, and also it's not just that; it's a very dangerous illusion because it's like grooming people to be killers. Now, you may think, well, this is only a game. Don't be silly, but there is an immense amount of psychology to this. And the other thing is, one of the things you'll see on the Call of Duty is that there are instances where people who can play the game well have then been approached. Okay. Now, quite whether that is by the military is not 100% certain, but those people who can play the game well, get very high scores, then get approached, maybe to get involved in things like game development, but quite possibly to be then sitting there flying a drone. That kind of thing in the real world.
So I mean, if you want to have your say on the program, 0121-772-8892. We are talking to Tony Gosling from BCFM. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM Birmingham, of course, and throughout the West Midlands. Now, we are in the middle of an interesting topic at the moment, video game. And sorry for interrupting there, Tony, but please do carry on.
Well, one of the other things I was going to say was the amount of time that young people invest in these games. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that mostly that sort of 60, 70-year-old pensioners play, no. they probably play a game of drafts or chess or backgammon, something like that.
Or even Monopoly.
More healthy. But it is colossal. It was an announcement over Christmas time that something, oh, now I can't remember the exact figures, but something like a million hours of playtime had been spent by young people on that game, just since it was released in November. Now, you think of the amount of young people's time that is taking up.
Well, I mean,
if this was something that you were paid to do, because in a way you're kind of, then it would be a fantastic fantastic amount of money.
Well, of course, I mean, and if you look at it now, Tony, I mean, with the consoles like the PlayStation 3, which is one of Sony's products, and the Xbox 360, which is a Microsoft product, if you look at those two consoles, and Michael Humane here will actually back me up on this, because he is into all that gaming stuff. Now, you can play online games against other gamers, and, you know, it's an excellent way, actually, to keep tracks on how many gamers are going online and, you know, their IP address and their scores.
Yeah, I just think that it's a, you know, the thing that I find so uncomfortable about it is getting a little bit too close to reality, especially when I saw... Yeah. I mean, it's all very well, you know, this is just a game, we're just playing a game here, but when I saw some pictures of, this was, I think, on Channel 4 News, two or three months ago, of the drones that were being operated in Pakistan to murder people from the air, assassinate people from the air, sometimes, you know, sort of destroying wedding parties, funeral parties, this kind of thing, you know, hundreds of people have been killed with these drones, then actually, I can't be 100% sure, but the controller that this young lad was using to fly the drone that would kill people, it looked very much like an Xbox controller. So this is the sort of thing that scares me, is actually that this is a very sophisticated psychological tool grooming our young people to become killers.
To become killers,
I mean, I think we might be making it in for the army as well, to groom young people to join the army, show the glamour side of it, you know?
Our armies, of course, are becoming very, very high tech. I mean, down here in Bristol, I don't know if people realise this, but there is something called the Corsham Computer Centre under the ground in Wiltshire, which I was told by somebody who was doing some electrical work in there. This is one of the places where the NATO battle computers are kept. Now, this means that a lot of what is actually going out there on the ground in Afghanistan is being controlled and monitored by computers. So, obviously, the individual soldiers will be feeding back information, but they think they have these little magic eyes on their helmet that can then feed information back to a battle computer. So, what's happening these days is actually the actual fighting of war itself is starting to come round to being something which is actually just something which is being... a little microprocessor somewhere is deciding what the next move is going to be in the battle.
Well, I mean, we've seen evidence of that with the new, again, going back to Israel, within their new equipment that they've got, and it is basically on their guns. It's like a control pad, and the commanders can actually control the troops from a command center and tell them the targets to shoot and to make their next move.
Well, this is all very, very high-tech stuff, and in fact... I'm not very far from Salisbury Plain here, and we were accidentally driving through Salisbury Plain when they were doing an exercise. I must have missed the red flags, you know, because they have a red flag up. And we heard, actually, a crack of gunfire. And as I turned around, I saw a column of soldiers marching. Now, I don't know if this is the kind of thing they do in Afghanistan, but they honestly look like a bunch of people from outer space. Now, look, I'm not saying that the British military are in contact with aliens. Just make that absolutely clear, right? But the soldiers of today and the high-tech battlefield actually do look in this kind of strange way, almost like sort of astronauts. You know, they've got obviously black and camouflage gear that they've got on, but they've got these kind of visors over their heads, and they've got the kind of what looks like some sort of computer aerial thing sticking up from the side of their helmet. It's very much a million miles away from what you would
basically
call digital warfare.
You know, basically from what you're describing there, Tony. I mean, they're basically human beings becoming basically bogging into their computer systems.
Well, the problem is, of course, that to have conscience, computers have absolutely no understanding. I would imagine, unless you can program a computer to include the Geneva Conventions. I don't know if they bother with that. But of course, there is actually no way that you can jail a computer for war crimes. You can't actually get a computer in the dock to explain why it did what it did. So what we're doing is, in a way, we're entering a very, very dangerous area here.
We are.
Some of the major decisions that are made in war fighting and on the battlefield are totally unaccountable, and they're just down to a little microchip.
Well, I will tell you this, actually, Tony. I mean, it's interesting. I've got, as you know, I'm visually impaired myself, and, you know, we do play some of the games, like, by keyboard controls and all that. And even if you look at some of the designs of some of these games, I mean, there's things like GMA Tank Commander and all that. And there's another one which is called 3D Velocity, and basically what that game is, is you have an aircraft and you're actually, you know, fighting a war battle through a simulator. You know, so it is, you know, I've actually spent one night, I actually spent 3-4 hours on that game trying to actually get my score a bit higher.
Well, look, back in the days of the old 386 computers, now that is a long time ago, it was probably 1993, 94, something like that. I did actually get quite obsessed with one of these flight simulator games.
Okay.
It was called Retaliator. I realised at the time, you know, you can actually get really, really drawn into these.
I probably spent
hours and hours on it. But then, at least, I know it might sound silly to you, but I used to think, well, I actually don't really want to actually shoot anything today. I'm just going to fly around and have a look around this.
But,
kind of,
you know, I mean, when you're sitting behind a control, that, you know, talking from my own experience, when you're sitting behind a control of that simulator, you actually do feel that you're in control, and, you know, you can get so sucked into it that you are actually thinking that, you know, you're actually, you know, in a real zone. And with a lot of the camera technology, with the Xbox and even the Sony PlayStation, these kind of things become reality, and because people can see each other and they can make moves on each other, kill each other in the game, they do have that greater control and it gives them that greater adrenaline.
Yeah, and isn't it frightening when you think that if a game is released in November, that there can be nearly 1 million hours of young people's time spent on it before Christmas? You know, this is, you know, what you're doing is a massive, massive amount of time is being spent on this stuff. Which could be actually used in some productive fashion. And, you know, actually what's going on, of course, is a lot of the jobs are being, you know, the futures and the livelihoods and careers for people in Britain are actually being sucked out of the country and they're going to places like China. You know, so our government seems to sort of I'm not just talking about the Cameron government, I'm talking about the new Labour government with Gordon Brown and Tony Blair before that. They seem to have this kind of mantra, which is, let's, you know, we've got to have globalization. We've got to just carry on.
Okay. The game itself, I mean, I've played a couple of times, and it's pretty addictive, but
Is this Call of Duty you're talking about?
Yeah.
Maybe we're advertising that now.
but before we actually continue with the topic, we do have a caller online. We lost the caller online 3. If you'd like to call back, 0121-772-8892. Do please continue, Tony.
It's a shame that we seem to be having quite a lot of problems with the phones tonight.
Yeah, do you apologize?
We are, actually.
You do apologize for that. As I was saying, Tony, I'm a big fan. Well, I'm not a big fan of the Black Ops, but
There is another big, you know, another big question with this video game is that all of the things that you're being asked to do as part of this game are completely immoral.
Yeah.
You know, like killing civilians, this kind of thing.
Okay, we do have our caller back on the line. Good evening.
Good evening, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Brother, I have two questions, very quickly.
Please ask away.
Yeah, first of all, brother, you know, your timing, I should basically not ask this question, but I like your program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I sometimes miss. So, is this program every time on the same day and same time?
Every Tuesday, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m.
8 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Yes. Every Tuesday, yes.
Exactly. The second question, brother, is that I am about like 34, 35 years old. And in my teenage years, there was a video game, a Street Fighter.
I remember that game very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to play that for hours and hours and hours. And my parents, they definitely never liked that. And they used to get very angry.
But, I mean, it's interesting you spent hours and hours on that, brother. Did you, you know, I mean, when you got hooked onto it, I mean, did you kind of feel that power, that you have that control, you know, that you want to make that move and, you know, kill that person or that character or that character?
You know, for me, it was not about the characters or killing, because it was a competition. Someone was there on the other side, and he was competing with me. So I was basically involved in defeating the other guy who was on the other side. So for me, the characters were not important. It was that, okay, I'm winning the game. That was the important thing for me.
How often did you play the game? How often do you play, for hours or just here
when
and there?
I have not played now video games for more than, I think, so 10, 15 years. But
at that time,
I used to play it daily, and I used to play it maybe, I think, so 6-7 hours at least daily.
That's a lot of hours.
It is a lot of hours.
But
But, you know, I've spoken to friends of mine here in Bristol who, I mean, I don't know what, it's probably a similar pattern elsewhere. That people, when they get back from work, they will almost start immediately playing as soon as they get home from work, and sometimes play and play and play until the early hours of the morning, maybe 4 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they'll go to bed, and then they'll have to get up for work again at 9, so they only have a few hours sleep. And that these games really can get obsessive, and people can get very, very addicted. Now,
I completely agree. Completely agree.
I actually played a game. This is not a violent game. It was called Civilization, I think, or something like that.
Okay.
And I remember actually installing it on my computer, playing it for about an hour and a half, and then just getting this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. Now, what have I just spent the last hour and a half doing? It's just a complete waste of time. But you know what I did? I just deleted the entire directory that I just installed it into. I'm never going to touch that again.
Wow.
Just because I just got a bad feeling in my stomach about it. You know, a sort of empty feeling. So I thought, I don't want to waste any more of my life playing this silly game. And I think that, you know, I'd like to just put a message out to the listeners to try and make sure that they're aware of the grip that these games can have on people, and to just break that grip if they possibly can.
It can be an addiction, these games. I mean, I got a friend who spends hours and hours just playing Black Ops. I remember when I was a bit younger, I used to play LMA Manager all day. It took me to complete it. So I know the feeling.
I think the other thing about all this is that this is an illusory world. Because the world that we live in, you know, the world outside there right now, it's becoming dark, difficult. It's becoming, you know, a lot of, you know, shops and facilities are closing down.
Well, I'm going to have to actually stop you there, Tony. I'm afraid
the swimming pools are closing down. Then we need something else, you know.
Absolutely.
And this is a replacement for the world that used to be out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, Tony, as I say, time is our only enemy on this programme. We have come to an end of this edition of Behind the Headlines. Just quickly, Tony, tell us what's on BCFM Friday Drive Time Show.
Well, I'm not absolutely sure this week. We've got a series running at the moment which is all about censorship. And we had, for example, last week we had a local entrepreneur and an architect. He's also one of the members of the Society of the Merchant Venturers. His name's George Ferguson. He's a big figure in Bristol. He's a, you know, really respected architect. Explaining how our local newspaper here, he wrote something in his column that he had in the weekly column he had in the Bristol Evening Post. And he explained how when he wrote something which was just gently critical of the Evening Post's bias towards building of a big new stadium in the city, that he was actually phoned up and told by the editor of the newspaper, I'm sorry, we're suspending your column. So this is just looking at the way, I mean, it's a whole series of pieces over the next few weeks, looking at the way that censorship operates. You know, there's all sorts of different ways that we don't actually see in the press what's really going on.
Well,
and that's what I'm looking at in the next few weeks.
Well, Tony Gosling, as ever, thank you very much for coming on the show again tonight, and we will speak to you same time, same place next Tuesday, all being well, and hopefully our technical issues will be sorted out well. We have come to an end of this edition of Behind the Headlines. If you want to drop in any comments on behind, just send us an email, behindtheheadlines935@hotmail.co.uk. My thanks to Brother Yassine for taking the phone call and helping me out in the first half of the show, and helping out with the phones and the computers today. My thanks to Humayun, to Martin Summers, to Tony Gosling as ever. My sincere apology to Alan Hart, because of a technical issue, we couldn't get him on the program, but we will get him on next week. Until then, it's good evening to all of you, and if you got little ones, give him a kiss, give him a hug, tell him you love him. Good evening, and good night to you all.
The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. 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 The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.